Chapter 45. Daylight had been wholly truthful when he told Deed that he had no real friends. On speaking terms with thousands, on fellowship and drinking terms with hundreds, he was a lonely man. He failed to find the one man, or group of several men, with whom he could be really intimate. Cities did not make for comradeship as did the Alaskan Trail. Besides, the types of men were different. Scornful and contemptuous of businessmen on the one hand, on the other his relations with the San Francisco bosses had been more an alliance of expediency than anything else. He had felt more of kinship for the franker brutality of the bosses and their captains, but they had failed to claim any deep respect. They were too prone to crookedness. Bonds were better than men's word in this modern world, and one had to look carefully to the bonds. In the old Yukon days it had been different. Bonds didn't go. A man said he had so much, and even in a poker game his appeasement was accepted. Larry Hegan, who rose ably to the largest demands of Daylight's operations, and who had few illusions and less hypocrisy, might have proved a chum had it not been for his temperamental twist. Strange genius that he was, a Napoleon of the law, with a power of visioning that far exceeded Daylight's, he had nothing in common with Daylight outside the office. He spent his time with books, a thing Daylight could not abide. Also, he devoted himself to the endless writing of plays which never got beyond manuscript form, and, though Daylight only sensed the secret taint of it, was a confirmed, but temperate eater of hashish. Hegan lived all his life cloistered with books, in a world of agitation. With the out-of-door world he had no understanding nor tolerance. In food and drink he was abstemious as a monk, while exercise was a thing abhorrent. Daylight's friendships, in lieu of anything closer, were drinking friendships and roistering friendships. And with the passing of the Sunday rides with Deed, he fell back more and more upon these for diversion. The cocktail wall of inhibition he reared more assiduously than ever. The big red motor car was out more frequently now, while a stable H, and was hired to give Bob exercise. In his early San Francisco days, there had been intervals of easement between his deals, but in this present biggest deal of all the strain was unremitting. Not in a month, or two, or three, could his huge land investment be carried to a successful consummation. And so complete and wide-reaching was it that complications and knotty situations constantly arose. Every day brought its problems, and when he had solved them in his masterful way, he left the office in his big car, almost sighing with relief at anticipation of the approaching double martini. Rarely was he made tipsy. His constitution was too strong for that. Instead, he was that direst of all drinkers, the steady drinker, deliberate and controlled, who averaged a far higher quantity of alcohol than the irregular and violent drinker. For 6 weeks hard running he had seen nothing of Deed except in the office, and there he resolutely refrained from making approaches. But by the seventh Sunday his hunger for her overmastered him. It was a stormy day. A heavy southeast gale was blowing, and squall after squall of rain and wind swept over the city. He could not take his mind off of her, and a persistent picture came to him of her sitting by a window and sewing feminine fripperies of some sort. When the time came for his first pre-luncheon cocktail to be served to him in his rooms, he did not take it. Filled with a daring determination, he glanced at his notebook for Deed's telephone number, and called for the switch. At first it was her landlady's daughter who was raised, but in a minute he heard the voice he had been hungry to hear. "I just wanted to tell you that I'm coming out to see you," he said. "Didn't want to break in on you without warning, that was all." "Has something happened?" came her voice. "I'll tell you when I get there," he evaded. He left the red car two blocks away, and arrived on foot at the pretty, three-storied, shingled Berkeley house. For an instant only, he was aware of an inward hesitancy, but the next moment he rang the bell. He knew that what he was doing was in direct violation of her wishes, and that he was setting her a difficult task, to receive as a Sunday caller the multimillionaire and notorious Elam Harnish of newspaper fame. On the other hand, the one thing he did not expect of her was what he would have termed silly female capers. And in this, he was not disappointed. She came herself to the door to receive him and shake hands with him. He hung his Macintosh and hat on the rack in the comfortable square hall and turned to her for direction. "They are busy in there," she said, indicating the parlor from which came the boisterous voices of young people, and through the open door of which he could see several college youths. "Oh, you will have to come into my rooms." She led the way through the door opening out of the hall to the right, and, once inside, he stood awkwardly rooted to the floor, gazing about him, and at her, and all the time trying not to gaze. In his perturbation he failed to hear and see her invitation to a seat. So these were her quarters. The intimacy of it and her making no fuss about it was startling, but it was no more than he would have expected of her. It was almost two rooms in one, the one he was in evidently the sitting room, and the one he could see into, the bedroom. Beyond an oaken dressing table, with an orderly litter of combs, and brushes and dainty feminine knick-knacks, there was no sign of its being used as a bedroom. The broad couch, with a cover of old rose and banked high with cushions, he decided must be the bed, but it was farthest from any experience of a civilized bed he had ever had. Not that he saw much of detail in that awkward moment of standing. His general impression was one of warmth and comfort and beauty. There were no carpets, and on the hardwood floor he caught a glimpse of several wolf and coyote skins. What captured and perceptibly held his eye for a moment was a crouched Venus that stood on a Steinway upright against a background of mountain lion skin on the wall. But it was Deed herself that smote most sharply upon sense and perception. He had always cherished the idea that she was very much a woman. The lines of her figure, her hair, her eyes, her voice, and bird-like laughing ways had all contributed to this. But here, in her own rooms, clad in some flowing, clinging gown, the emphasis of sex was startling. He had been accustomed to her only in trim tailor suits and shirt waists, or in riding costume of velvet corduroy, and he was not prepared for this new revelation. She seemed so much softer, so much more pliant, and tender, and lissome. She was a part of this atmosphere of quietude and beauty. She fitted into it just as he had fitted in with the sober office furnishings. "Won't you sit down?" she repeated. He felt like an animal long denied food. His hunger for her welled up in him, and he proceeded to off the dainty morsel before him. Here was no patience, no diplomacy. The straightest, direct way was none too quick for him, and, had he known it, the least unsuccessful way he could have chosen. "Look here," he said, in a voice that shook with passion, "there's one thing I won't do, and that's propose to you in the office. That's why I'm here. Deed Mason, I want you. I just want you." While he spoke he advanced upon her, his black eyes burning with bright fire, his aroused blood swarthy in his cheek. So precipitate was he, that as he had barely time to cry out her involuntary alarm, and to step back, at the same time catching one of his hands as he attempted to gather her into his arms. In contrast to him, the blood had suddenly left her cheeks. The hand that had warded his off and that still held it, was trembling. She relaxed her fingers, and his arm dropped to his side. She wanted to say something, do something, to pass on from the awkwardness of the situation, but no intelligent thought nor action came into her mind. She was aware only of a desire to laugh. This impulse was partly hysterical, and partly spontaneous humor, the latter growing from instant to instant. Amazing as the affair was, the ridiculous side of it was not veiled to her. She felt like one who had suffered the terror of the onslaught of a murderous footpad only to find out that it was an innocent pedestrian asking the time. Daylight was the quicker to achieve action. "H, I know I'm a sure enough fool," he said. "I guess I'll sit down. Don't be scared, Miss Mason. I'm not real dangerous. I'm not afraid, she answered, with a smile, slipping down herself into a chair, beside which, on the floor, stood a sewing basket from which, Daylight noted, some white fluffy thing of lace and muslin overflowed. Again she smiled. Hawk, I confess you did startle me for the moment. It's funny, Daylight sighed, almost with regret. Here I am, strong enough to bend you around and tie knots in you. Here I am, used to having my will with man and beast and anything. And here I am sitting in this chair, as weak and helpless as a little lamb. You sure take the starch out of me. Deet vainly cudgeled her brains in quest of a reply to these remarks. Instead, her thought dwelt insistently upon the significance of his stepping aside, in the middle of a violent proposal, in order to make irrelevant remarks. What struck her was the man's certitude. So little did he doubt that he would have her, that he could afford to pause and generalize upon love and the effects of love. She noted his hand unconsciously slipping in the familiar way into the side coat pocket, where she knew he carried his tobacco and brown papers. You may smoke, if you want to, she said. He withdrew his hand with a jerk, as if something in the pocket had stung him. No, I wasn't thinking of smoking. I was thinking of you. What's a man to do when he wants a woman, but ask her to marry him? That's all that I'm doing. I can't do it in style. I know that. But I can use straight English, and that's good enough for me. I sure want you mighty bad, Miss Mason. You're in my mind most all the time now. And what I want to know is, well, do you want me? That's all. I wish you hadn't asked, she said softly. Meb, it's best you should know a few things before you give me an answer, he went on, ignoring the fact that the answer had already been given. Never went after a woman before in my life, all reports to the contrary notwithstanding. The stuff you read about me in the papers and books, about me being a lady killer, is all wrong. There's not an iota of truth in it. I guess I've done more than my share of card playing and whiskey drinking, but women I've let alone. There was a woman that killed herself, but I didn't know she wanted me that bad, or else I'd have married her not for love, but to keep her from killing herself. She was the best of the boiling, but I never gave her any encouragement. I'm telling you all this, because you've read about it, and I want you to get it straight from me. Lady killer, he snorted. Hi, Miss Mason, I don't mind telling you that I've sure been scared of women all my life. You're the first one I've not been afraid of. That's the strange thing about it. I just plumb worship you, and yet I'm not afraid of you. Meb, it's because you're different from the women I know. You've never chased me. Lady killer. Why, I've been running away from ladies ever since I can remember, and I guess all that saved me was that I was strong in the wind, and that I never fell down and broke a leg or anything. I didn't ever want to get married until after I met you, and until a long time after I met you. I cottoned to you from the start, but I never thought it would get as bad as marriage. Why, I can't get to sleep nights, thinking of you and wanting you. He came to a stop and waited. As he had taken the lace and muslin from the basket, possibly to settle her nerves and wits, and was sewing upon it. As she was not looking at him, he devoured her with his eyes. He noted the firm, efficient hands that could control a horse like Bob, that could run a typewriter almost as fast as a man could talk, that could sew on dainty garments, and that, doubtlessly, could play on the piano over there in the corner. Another ultra-feminine detail, he noticed her slippers. They were small and bronze. He had never imagined as he had such a small foot. Street shoes and riding boots were all that he had ever seen on her feet, and they had given no advertisement of this. The bronze slippers fascinated him, and to them his eyes repeatedly turned. A knock came at the door, which she answered. Daylight could not help hearing the conversation. She was wanted at the telephone. Tell him to call up again in 10 minutes, he heard her say, and the masculine pronoun caused in him a flashing twinge of jealousy. Well, he decided, Whoever it was, Burning Daylight would give him a run for his money. The marvel to him was that a girl like Deed hadn't been married long since. She came back, smiling to him, and resumed her sewing. His eyes wandered from the efficient hands to the bronze slippers and back again, and he swore to himself that there were mighty few stenographers like her in existence. That was because she must have come of pretty good stock, and had a pretty good raising. Nothing else could explain these rooms of hers and the clothes she wore, and the way she wore them. Those 10 minutes are flying, he suggested. I can't marry you, she said. You don't love me? She shook her head. Do you like me the littlest bit? This time she nodded, at the same time allowing the smile of amusement to play on her lips. But it was amusement without contempt. The humorous side of a situation rarely appealed in vain to her. Well, that's something to go on, he announced. Ooh, I've got to make a start to get started. I just liked you at first, and look what it's grown into. You recollect, you said you didn't like my way of life. Well, I've changed it a heap. I ain't gambling like I used to. I've gone into, what you call the legitimate, making 2 minutes grow where one grew before, 300,000 folks, where only 100,000 grew before. And this time next year there'll be 2 million eucalyptus growing on the hills. Say, do you like me more than the littlest bit? She raised her eyes from her work, and looked at him as she answered. I like you a great deal, but, he waited a moment for her to complete the sentence, failing. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.